All right, so we've been talking for some weeks as after we came out of the Anapanasati sequence. We got into talking a bit about cessation and Nibbana and the characteristics of change and unsatisfactoriness and selflessness, anicca, dukkha, and anatta. And then I let anatta unfold into reflections on rebirth. We've been talking for a couple of weeks about these, for some of us, quite natural feeling, and for others of us, quite difficult doctrines on what we make of really the ancient Buddhist idea that that birth follows birth in an experiential chain, so that there's something that the person experiences on and on and on, even though nothing in that ongoing experience can be called a self, that there's something that's continuous, and that thing that's continuous is kamma, or action, that our actions bear fruit, and consequentially, right? No, nobody in the modern period, like, you know, contemporary Buddhist worlds, like, nobody's going to say that actions don't bear fruit. No one is overtly a nihilist, generally, or doesn't admit it anyway. But the Buddhist idea that actions bear fruit doesn't just mean that actions have impacts. That's the contemporary way of thinking about it. Like for others, actions bearing fruit really means actions bear fruit for the one who does the action. So your own actions, and particularly charged by their ethical valence, whether they cause harm or cause help in the world, those actions bear fruit in the form of your own future mind states, states of the mind and heart. And so you know, one way to think about the doctrines of rebirth is that, you know, not in such an esoteric way, but in a way of saying, okay, if that's the basic premise, actions bear fruit for the one who does the action, that must mean that good actions are going to bear positive fruit and bad actions are going to bear negative fruit. But a quick glance around the world, and this was true, they talked about this in the Buddha's time, and it's clearly still true now, that some people do quite terrible actions and don't appear to reap the fruit. They don't appear to suffer, you know, or be, you know, cosmically punished in a certain way. I think all of the religions tried to figure this out, you know, like I grew up Catholic, and, you know, it was clear that some really evil people did quite well in this life. And so then it kind of makes sense to be like, yeah, well, it's going to be really bad for them later on, you know. Like, there's a reason, I think, that those doctrines of, you know, heavenly blessing and hellish punishment developed. And they develop in the Buddhist world as well, right? Because it's clear that not all evil gets punished in this lifetime. And it's clear that not all saintliness gets rewarded in this lifetime, right? Some quite lovely people have a really terrible time of it and don't seem to get what they deserve in terms of good fortune. And some really terrible people seem to, you know, get a lot of comfort and wealth and power. And one wishes they would get what one thinks they might deserve, and they don't seem to necessarily. So the ancient Buddhists tried to figure this out. And one of the solutions was that, well, they get it eventually. And the Buddha was very clear about this. He said that there's karma that ripens immediately, which means in this lifetime. And there's karma that ripens shortly, like in the next lifetime. And there's karma that ripens kind of at an unknown future time. you know. And that works for both positive and negative karma, you know. The doctrine developed that even the most evil people in the Buddha's world, Devadatta, his cousin who tried to kill him, Angulimala, the serial killer who became enlightened quite quickly, actually, after meeting the Buddha, Ajatasattu, the king who killed his father for the throne, and did not become enlightened in this lifetime. You know, even Devadatta, who's really the most evil person in the Buddha's story, the idea developed that he too would become a Buddha one day. He would become a Pacheka Buddha, a private Buddha, but he would eventually become liberated. And it's resonant a bit with a story from the Hindu tradition that talks about, it's kind of an alternate story of Ravana, the demon king of the island of Lanka, who, you know, who's the villain of the Ramayana, the great story of Rama and Sita. And so Ravana kidnaps Sita, takes her to the island of Lanka, which is the seed for Rama to assemble an army, partly led by his dear friend Hanuman, the great monkey, to go to Lanka and rescue Sita. And in a gloriously heroic story with some complex, difficult twists and turns in the middle and at the end. But one of the stories about Ravana, the demon king, he's not quite the right word, it's a translation. He's a Rakshasa, he's one of the fierce divine beings, but he's a king. One of the stories about him is that he's so obsessed with Rama by hating him, right? Like he really wants to kill Rama, he really wants to defeat Rama, but he's obsessed. And so that's all he thinks about. He just thinks, oh, Rama, Rama, Rama. Oh, that terrible guy, Rama, I'm going to get him, Rama, Rama. But of course, you know, what is it to be saying Ram, Ram, Ram? That's the mantra. That's the prayer. That's the great prayer. And so, you know, completely without having the intention to worship Rama, he's saying the mantra Ram, Ram, Ram over and over. And because of that, he gains the good karma of having intoned the holy name and installed the holy name in his heart, and he becomes liberated partly because of this focus. So that was really a tangent, but I like that story. Ravana actually becomes quite important in the Buddhist world, in the Mahayana Buddhist world. There's a very important Mahayana Sutra, the Lankavatara Sutra, in which Ravana is actually the hero and the devotional figure at the heart of the text. So the Buddhists, you know, wrestled as we do with this idea that you know, good and evil don't always seem to get their just recompense in this lifetime, and but the Buddha was clear that recompense comes eventually. So that's one of the reasons why we might not so much like take on the doctrine of rebirth in a literal way, like, oh, you have to believe in this thing that somehow goes so against the materialistic kind of naturalistic theory that we mostly live under, but as we've been talking about, to really wrestle with the same problems that the original thinkers wrestled with. You know, what do you do with the intuition that you might have that good and evil or right and wrong action is at the heart of the universe, is at the heart of our practice, is the heart of what makes meaning in the world? And how do you feel into what the results of action could be or should be? How do we relate to the possibility of all of our actions bearing fruit in our own experience, even if not in this lifetime? And this proposal forces us to wrestle with a deep kind of nihilism that's at the heart of modern life. If you've turned yourself away from one of the traditional, like the Western religions at least, or from any great religion that believes in a life after death, if you've taken up the scientific religion, the scientific materialist religion of late, and you find yourself convinced that at death, nothing is experienced afterward, that consciousness is purely a byproduct of physiological processes, and that after death there is simply nothing. The rebirth teachings, I think, just challenge us to then reckon with what we think liberation might be then. If at death everything simply ends, if there's no suffering past death in any way for anyone, nothing, really, really nothing, why would we seek liberation? Liberation is difficult. The path is difficult. It is not easy to fully uproot greed, hatred, and delusion from the heart. Why would it not be enough to work for, a modicum of comfort and psychological ease and let it be at that? Let's say that's enough. I'm going to work for goodness in the world. I'm going to trust that my actions have an impact beyond myself for others. But that when I'm done living this body, that whatever good or evil I've done, it all gets washed away. And I'm just finished. Just notice if you've absorbed that view. That's the standard post-Christian view around here, anyway, in kind of progressive, even if you tend on the animist direction or you tend in the other kinds of spiritualist directions, a lot of those traditions can just propose that upon death, maybe you're comforted by the idea that you just become soil again and mycelium, which you do, your body does, certainly. So that's good. Blessings to the fungi. And if you really can't wrap yourself around the sense that you might experience further suffering, that's really the kicker. Further suffering, like, being reborn again and again is suffering. That's what the Buddha said from in the Dhammapada, right? Repeated birth is suffering. The Buddha says, many times, so many times have I been born and built this house. To be born again and again is suffering. You will not build a house again, right? I will not build a house again. The ridgepole is broken. The rafters destroyed. The mind has gone to the end of craving. There's really the very clear message that from a system of endlessly repeated birth and death and suffering, the mind can go to a place where there is no longer birth and death and suffering. That is different from the idea that everything just ends at death. So I think the rebirth teachings challenge us to wrestle with this. And they don't offer an easy answer because, I have really tried to just straight up believe the literal rebirth story. Like if anyone has made a go of it from a Western, postmodern, condition, I have made a go of it. And it's not meant to be an article of faith. And as such, it resists belief. You can try to believe in it. But it's not really any more believable than heaven and hell was. Because you may well have, if you're in a group like this, you probably have absorbed a kind of culture that is post-mythic or post, modern, at least, but you probably don't believe in metaphysical stories in the same way that many of your ancestors did. And you can't just get that back. You can't just decide to once again believe metaphysical stories. We have to find a different pathway to get there. And so part of what I've been proposing is that we don't try to believe the metaphysical story or the supernatural story, but we engage with the mysterious evidence that people have experiences of being someone else, that that there are mystical experiences that open toward the universe not being exactly what we think it is in the scientific, naturalistic, materialistic view, and that we actually wrestle with those, that we wrestle with the implications of psychedelic experience, that we wrestle with the implications of shamanic experience, that we wrestle with the implications of jhana, of the absorbed states of mind where the sense of individual self can dissolve profoundly into utter stability and stillness, into emptiness, into infinite space, infinite consciousness, into the sense that there is nothing. That we actually learn from these states. Now that's challenging partly because you have to practice them and they're not easy. But I think that is partly what we are pointing toward here. And so at the end of our gathering last week, David asked a question that I'm going to interpret here as, how do we practice with this? What do we actually do or bring into daily life practice, ordinary life practice? And I think this is always a direction to return to, but particularly when we're getting really philosophical or abstract or metaphysical. And the place I want to start is one of the most uncomfortable places in the teachings. And you know I like to spend a little time with the more uncomfortable teachings. I listened this past weekend to a Dhamma talk from one of Ajahn Chah's Thai disciples, Ajahn Anan, a wonderful teacher that you can find on YouTube, A-N-A-N, Ajahn Anan. And I listened to a talk that he gave for the Lunar New Year, which just passed. It just happened on the 10th. It was this last moon entering the Yang Wood Dragon year, coming out of Yin Water Rabbit. And it was a very, very straightforward talk. It was a beautiful talk. And like many of the Thai teachers and some Burmese teachers as well, there's been a focus in recent years of orienting the teachings toward the Chinese, toward Chinese folks living in diaspora in Southeast Asia, and also broadcasting the teachings into China. There's a couple of Saida Utejaniya in Burma has been very substantially focusing his ministry on the Chinese. He's not really interested in the Westerners anymore, kind of coming over. Really wants to help reestablish Buddhism in China. And there's been enough of a softening from the communist government that there's some open space for Buddhism to re-arise in China. And so this talk, you know, felt like it fit right into that direction. But the first thing that Ajahn Anan was talking about was around this holiday of the new year being an occasion for generating merit, for making offerings, and particularly for making offerings of blessings towards one's ancestors. And And the most immediate form of that is this practice that I'm saying only slightly tongue-in-cheek is one of the most difficult practices in the Buddhist system right now. And this is the practice of honoring your parents. So first of all, just notice how you feel about that when I say it, because a lot of us find this practice actually quite uncomfortable. And if you don't, and you find it quite easy to honor your parents, I don't mean love them or like them or be friends with them, but I mean honor them, like really have gratitude for what they gave you, for the hard work of raising you, for all the suffering they endured, for all the resources they directed your way. Gratitude for one's parents is as much at the heart of the Buddha's teachings as samadhi and mindfulness. It's right at the beginning of the teachings. And it's not just a quaint old South Asian teaching. It's much, much more than that, because it points toward the profundity of rebirth. The teaching on rebirth is that we are born into whatever situation or station in life we find ourselves in at this time around, as a result of our own past actions. Having anything like what I think most of you, if not all, have experienced in this life is considered to be the result of outrageous good fortune. If you were born not in a war zone, if you were born not in crushing poverty, if you were born and grew up with in a non-abusive household, or with enough to eat, or with an education, or with protection from violence and harm, all of those are considered very good fortune. If you were born in a situation where you were able to find the Dharma and be on a spiritual path and have the free time and interest, lots of people have comfort and free time and resources to spend, and they could spend it on pursuing the Dharma. And as you well know, lots of people use their resources on all sorts of things that are not the Dharma. But here you are, of all the things you could be doing on a Tuesday night, doing this, being interested in the Dharma and being born in a time when there is Dharma to study and when there are Dharma communities to be a part of, this is considered to be an extraordinary blessing. And as the Mangala Sutta begins, honoring those who are worthy of honor, this is the highest blessing. This is the blessing of having good friends, having Dharma friends, being able to be in Dharma community. And so honoring one's parents is a way of connecting to the good fortune of having been born in the conditions that we were born in that are so good. Now, it's important to say here that good conditions is not a black and white situation. And lots of us were born in, all of us were born in conditions that had some good qualities to them and some not so good qualities to them. And some of us were born in conditions that were quite not good, in all sorts of ways, and deep compassion and metta for that experience, right? So that's true too, right? And it's one of the things that's difficult about this teaching, I think, is that the Buddha doesn't give it with a lot of caveats. Like, oh, well, if you came from an abusive home, well, you don't need to be grateful for your parents so much. If you came from, you know, if your parents are kind of just terrible people, you don't need to be grateful for them very much. Those are the caveats that we often kind of have to give to be sensitive to trauma in the contemporary world. And I bow to that reality. And the teaching is to be grateful for one's parents, to honor one's parents, and to differentiate gratitude and honoring. But gratitude is one thing, it's a quality to develop. honoring, in a way, is a ritual that one can do regardless of whether there's gratitude or loving kindness. But you can just honor. And in a certain way, right, there's a way that and the Chinese tradition knows this well, that honoring the dead, honoring one's ancestors, is actually a way to, because they're not gone, right? Again, rebirth and the presence of ancestors, but that honoring the ancestors is actually one way to help them heal and not be malevolent spirits and actually become helpful spirits. And terrible people can become good ancestors. One of the ways they can do that is through being the recipient of ritual and honoring. So one of the places that ancestors can go that's really painful is the realm of the hungry ghosts. And being born in the ghost realm is a result of terrible actions of some kind during life. And so perhaps you have some terrible ancestors. I mean, we all have some terrible ancestors. So there they are, who may have been born in the ghost realm. And one of the ways to rescue people from the ghost realm is to do something wholesome, like give dana or make merit in some way, and direct the merit toward them, to wish them well, to make merit on their behalf. And so, you know, in a way, it's a beautiful gesture to do something meritorious and make an offering for the blessing of, you know, not our favorite grandparents, but our least favorite ones, the abusive ones, the angry ones, because sending merit their way actually is a way to help them recover from those terrible states. So I invite us to wrestle with the practice of honoring our parents. Yes, it might be easier to honor them once they're dead than living, but make a go of it. And I'm proposing, in a way, that this kind of practice, so this is loving kindness practice, this is ritual honoring, this is being in a heart or in a living relationship with those who are beyond the realm of form, that this is actually one of the ways we can practice with the ideas, the doctrine around rebirth. In a way, what we're doing is we're practicing as if it's real. What if it's real, you know? The Buddha says there's not a single person in the world who has not at some point been your own mother. Right? Rebirth is not just a short-term limited, like, you know, before I was born in this body, I was this person here, and before that I was this person there, and at one point I was this monkey, and at one point I was Cleopatra. A lot of us were Cleopatra. I don't know. It's a powerful being. You know, it's not a linear sequence of important humans that we were. Right? It's more like it's more like a fractal with infinite folding and folding interwoven threads, where everybody's been everything to everybody else, right? When the Buddha says, you know, cosmic eons expanding and contracting, I remembered my lives through all of this. Everyone is cycling around through everywhere. There's stories in the texts about people falling in love and then being born in various relationships with each other over and over for thousands of years, hundreds of relationships. The woman who gave the Buddha his meal, nourishing his body before the enlightenment, Venerable Sujata, was said to have been his mother in hundreds of previous lifetimes. When she came out and saw him under the tree, she began to lactate. She wasn't his mother in this lifetime, but she had been his mother in many lifetimes before. I think the mystery that we're being asked to embrace here is the mystery of profound interconnection. And not just interconnection, but like familial interconnection, that we are related to everyone. That we have been related to everyone, we are currently related to everyone. In a way that blows the ideas of individual family relations, you know, out of the water in a way. Like you're related to your immediate family line, you have your immediate ancestors, yes, venerate them, you know, honor them, make offerings on their behalf. But we do that because we remember that we had good karma to be born in their care, and that their care is good karma for them to be born in further good places. The care that they gave to us and the merit that we give to them by honoring them. And that as we remember that, we connect with having been related to them before, having been related to each other before. When the Buddha tells his Jataka stories and stories of his past lives, the personages in the story are always the same people that are around him now. He says, oh, well, I was, you know, I was that king's advisor, and the other minister was Ananda, and the mother seeking help was Venerable Sariputta, and, you know, the evil minister was Devadatta. It's always Devadatta. It's like the Buddha can see, right? This is his clairvoyance that shows him this. The Buddha can see that he's been hanging out with his friends for eons, practicing together, right? And I told you some weeks recently that, you know, this story of Dipa Ma saying that she remembered that she had been with the Buddha. And so she used her recollection of past lives to remember all the way back to the time of the Buddha and to listen to him directly teaching in that time. And whatever you make of that, whether it was a kind of mystical lucid dream vision, whether it was shamanic, if you want to use that kind of language, if it was a sort of visionary practice, if she was remembering the literal past lives. I think what she was remembering was relatedness, and that we're related to all of those in the past, and how we act and move in the present creates relationality, and that relationality then unfolds into the future. So I think we practice with this, not by trying to wrestle with the doctrine, but by acting in a way that demonstrates that we respect the teaching of interconnectedness, that we respect relationality, that we respect the mystery of being connected. And that we don't decide in some rigid way that we know what's going to happen after we die. I think to reject, you know, a teaching like rebirth, which, you know, again is just a way of explaining a thing that happens where people remember things, and what do you do with those memories? To reject it out of hand is a way of saying that you know something that you don't actually have enough information to know. The thing about rebirth is that it's supposed to be confirmable through meditative practice. It's not supposed to be an article of faith. You practice, you have vision, and you see this. It's an insight. And so, you know, by definition, if you haven't had the insight, you don't know what it's like. It's the same way that people say, you know, they're afraid of getting attached to jhana, to the deep meditative absorptions. If you've never been in them, you have no idea what it's like. Of course you're afraid of them in some way, right? If you've never experienced the insight into selflessness, of course you might well think that it doesn't sound very good, or or it doesn't sound true. I know people who say, you know, enlightenment, I don't want that, right? From the way it sounds, I don't want that. It's a little bit like a 10-year-old, you know, hearing, well, let's not make them 10. Let's say there's a 14-year-old who's never had an orgasm, and somebody comes along, some, you know, 16-year-old, let's say, to make it not too inappropriate, comes along and says, let me tell you about this thing. It kind of feels like this. It's totally trippy. It's going to happen. And the 14-year-old's like, that sounds terrible. I don't want that at all. You know, I don't want to have one of those. Right? Sounds like a seizure. Like whatever. Right? If you don't know what it's like, there's no way for you to either accept it or deny it. Right? You're just deluded. And so that's true for the meditative states. That's true for insight. And I think it's true for this realization of the reality of rebirth, that there is something real about it. The supernatural literalist explanation probably is not really what we think it is. And there's no way for us to assess it until we've had that insight and can actually parse for ourselves what it means to be visionary in that way. And only with that kind of vision can we reckon with what it means for ourselves. Like what it means traditionally is liberative. The Buddha doesn't say like, it's important to remember your past lives because it's cool to know who you were before. You remember your past lives because that's the first step in unbinding from further ones, from further suffering. And so there's really, the imperative here is just to practice in a way that respects the mystery, I think, and then to develop the mind states that allow us to be present for the unfolding of that mystery in our own life stream. So, all right, we'll pause there. Thanks for listening. Blessings always.